Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 6. From daylight until late in the evening, Seaton worked in the shop, sometimes supervising expert mechanics, sometimes working alone. Every night when Crane went to bed, he saw Seaton in his room in a cloud of smoke, poring over blueprints, or seated at the computer, making interminable calculations. Deaf to Crane's remonstrances, he was driving himself at an unhuman rate, completely absorbed in his project. While he did not forget Dorothy, he had a terrific lot to do, and none of it was getting done. He was going to see her just as soon as he was over this hump, he insisted. But every hump was followed by another, higher and worse. And day after day went by. Meanwhile, Dorothy was feeling considerably glum. Here was her engagement only a week old, and what an engagement! Before that enchanted evening, he had been an almost daily visitor. They had ridden and talked and played together, and he had forced his impetuous way into all her plans. And now, after she'd promised to marry him, he'd called once, at 11 o'clock, with his mind completely out of this world, and she hadn't even heard from him for 6 long days. A queer happening at the laboratory seemed scant excuse for such long-continued neglect, and she knew no other. Puzzled and hurt, her mother's solicitous looks unbearable, she left the house for a long, aimless walk. She paid no attention to the spring beauty around her. She did not even notice footsteps following her, and was too deeply engrossed in her own somber thoughts to be more than mildly surprised when Martin Crane spoke to her. For a while she tried to rouse herself into animation, but her usual ease had deserted her, and her false gaiety did not deceive the keen-minded Crane. Soon they were walking along together in silence, a silence finally broken by the man. "I've just left Seaton," he said. Paying no attention to her startled glance, he went on. "Did you ever see anyone else with his singleness of purpose? Of course, though, that is one of the traits that make him what he is. He's working himself into a breakdown. Has he told you about leaving the rare metals laboratory?"
"No, I haven't seen him since the night the accident or discovery or whatever it was happened. He tried to explain it to me then, but what little I could understand of what he said sounded simply preposterous."
"I can't explain the thing to you. Dick himself can't explain it to me. But I can give you an idea of what we both think it may come to."
"I wish you would. I'll be mighty glad to hear it."
"Dick discovered something that converts copper into pure energy. That water bath took off in a straight line."
"That still sounds preposterous, Martin," the girl interrupted, "even when you say it."
"Careful, Dorothy," he cautioned her. "Nothing that actually happens is or can be preposterous. But as I said, this copper bath left Washington in a straight line for scenes unknown. We intend to follow it in a suitable vehicle." He paused, looking at his companion's face. She did not speak, and he went on in his matter-of-fact tone. "Building the spaceship is where I come in. As you know, I have almost as much money as Dick has brains, and some day before the summer is over, we expect to go somewhere, someplace a considerable distance from this earth." Then, after enjoining strict secrecy, he told her what he had seen in the laboratory and described the present state of affairs.
"But if he thought of all that, was brilliant enough to work out such a theory, and to actually plan such an unheard-of thing as space travel, all on such a slight foundation of fact, why couldn't he have told me? He fully intended to. He still intends to. Don't believe for a moment that his absorption implies any lack of love for you. I was coming to visit you about that when I saw you out here. He is driving himself unmercifully. He eats hardly anything and doesn't seem to sleep at all. He has to take it easy or break down, but nothing I can say has had any effect. Can you think of anything you and I together can do?
Dorothy still walked alone, but it was a different Dorothy. She was erect and springy. Her eyes sparkled. All her charm and vitality were back in force.
I'll say I can, she breathed. I'll stuff him to the ears and put him to sleep right after dinner. The big dope.
This time it was Crane who was surprised, so surprised that he stopped practically in mid-stride.
How? He demanded. You talk about something being preposterous. Well, how?
And maybe you hadn't better know the gory details. She grinned impishly. You lack quite a bit, Marty, of being the world's best actor. And Dick mustn't be warned. Just run along home and be sure you're there when I get there. I've got to do some phoning. I'll be there at 6 o'clock and tell Shiro not to make you two any dinner.
She was there at 6 o'clock.
Where is he, Marty? Out in the shop?
Yes. In the shop, she strode purposefully toward Seton's oblivious back.
Hi, Dick. How's it coming?
Huh? He started violently, almost jumping off his stool, then did jump off it as the knowledge filtered through that it was really Dorothy who was standing at his back. He swept her off her feet in the intensity of his embrace. She pressed her every inch tighter and tighter against his rock-hard body. Their lips met and clung. Dorothy finally released herself enough to look into his eyes.
I was so mad, Dick. I simply didn't know whether to kiss you or kill you, but I decided to kiss you this time.
I know, sweetheart, I've been trying my level best to get a couple of hours to come over and see you, but everything's been going so slow. My head's so thick it takes 1,000 years for an idea to percolate.
Hush. I've been doing a lot of thinking this last week, especially today. I love you as you are. I can either do that or give you up. I can't even imagine giving you up because I know I'd cold-bloodedly strangle with her own hair any woman who ever cocked an eye at you. Come on, Dick. No more work tonight. I'm taking you and Martin home for dinner.
Then as his eyes strayed involuntarily back toward the computer, she said more forcefully,
I said no more work tonight. Do you want to fight about it?
I'll say I don't. I wasn't even thinking of working.
Seton was panic-stricken. No fights, Dottie, not with you ever, about anything, believe me.
I do love her. In arms around each other, they strolled unhurriedly up to and into the house.
Crane accepted enthusiastically, for him, the invitation to dinner and was going to dress, but Dorothy would not have it.
Strictly informal, she insisted, just as you are.
I'll wash up then and be with you in a sec, Seton said and left the room. Dorothy turned to Crane.
I've got a tremendous favor to ask of you, Martin. I drove the cad, it's air-conditioned, you know. Could you possibly bring your Stradivarius along? My best violin would do, I'm sure, but I'd rather have the heaviest artillery I can get.
I see, at last. Crane's face lit up. Certainly. Play it outdoors in the rain, if necessary. Masterful strategy, Dorothy. Masterful.
Well, one does what one can,
Dorothy murmured in mock modesty. Then as Seton appeared, she said,
Let's go, boys. Dinner is served at 7:30 sharp, and we're going to be there right on the chime.
As they sat down at the table, Dorothy studied again the changes that 6 days had made in Seton. His face was pale and thin, almost haggard. Lines had appeared at the corners of his eyes and around his mouth, and faint but unmistakable blue rings encircled his eyes.
"You've been going altogether too hard, Dick. You've got to cut down."
"Oh, no, I'm all right. I never felt better. I could whip a rattlesnake and give him the first bite."
She laughed, but the look of concern did not leave her face. During the meal, no mention was made of the project, the conversation being deftly held to tennis, swimming, and other sports, and Seton, whose plate was unobtrusively kept full, ate such a dinner as he had not eaten for weeks. After dessert, they all went into the living room and ensconced themselves in comfortable chairs. The men smoked, and all 5 continued their conversation. After a time, 3 left the room. Vanaman took Crane into his study to show him a rare folio. Mrs. Vanaman went upstairs, remarking plaintively that she had to finish writing that article, and if she put it off much longer, she'd never get it done. Dorothy said,
"I skipped practice today, Dick, on account of traipsing out there after you 2 geniuses. Could you stand it to have me play at you for 30 minutes?
"Don't fish, Dotty Dimple. You know there's nothing I'd like better. But if you want me to beg you, I'll be glad to."
"Please, please, O fair musicianly damsel, fill ye circumambient atmosphere with thy tuneful notes."
"Wilco, Roger," she snickered, "over and out." She took up a violin, Crane's violin, and played, first his favorites, crashing selections from operas and solos by the great masters, abounding in harmonies on 2 strings. Then she slowly changed her playing to softer, simpler melodies, then to old, old songs. Seton, listening with profound enjoyment, relaxed more and more. Pipe finished and hands at rest, his eyes closed of themselves and he lay back at ease. The music changed again gradually to reveries, each one softer, slower, dreamier than the last, then to sheer crooning lullabies, and it was in these that magnificent instrument and consummate artist combined to show their true qualities at their very best. Dorothy diminuendoed the final note into silence and stood there, bow poised, ready to resume, but there was no need. Freed from the tyranny of the brain that had been driving it so unmercifully, Seton's body had begun to make up for many hours of lost sleep. Assured that he was really asleep, Dorothy tiptoed to the door of the study and whispered,
"He's asleep in his chair."
"I believe that," her father smiled. "That last one was like a bottle of Veronol. It was all Crane and I could do to keep each other awake. You're a smart girl."
"She is a musician," Crane said. "What a musician."
"Partly me, of course, but what a violin. But what'll we do with him? Let him sleep there?"
"No, he'd be more comfortable on the couch." "I'll get a couple of blankets," Vanaman said. He did so, and the 3 went into the living room together. Seton lay motionless, only the lifting and falling of his powerful chest showing that he was alive.
"You take his..."
"Shh, shh," Dorothy whispered intensely. "You'll wake him up, Dad."
"Bosh! You couldn't wake him up now with a club. Now you take his head and shoulders, Crane. Heave-ho!"
With Dorothy anxiously watching the proceedings and trying to help, the 2 men picked Seton up out of the chair and carried him across the room to the couch. They removed his outer clothing. The girl arranged pillows and tucked blankets around him, then touched her lips lightly to his.
"Good night, sweetheart," she whispered.
His lips responded faintly to her caress, and
Night, he murmured in his sleep. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon when Seaton, looking vastly better, came into the shop. When Crane saw him and called out a greeting, he returned it with a sheepish grin. Don't say a word, Martin. I'm thinking it all, and then some. I never felt so cheap in my life as when I woke up on the Vannemans' couch this noon, where you helped put me, no doubt.
No doubt at all, Crane agreed cheerfully. And listen to this. More of the same or worse, if you keep on going as you were.
Don't rub it in. Can't you see I'm flat on my back with all four paws in the air? I'll be good. I'm going to bed at 11 every night, and I'm going to see Dottie every other evening and all day Sunday.
Very fine, if true, and it had better be true.
It will, so help me. Well, while I was eating breakfast this morning, this afternoon, I saw that missing factor in the theory. Don't tell me it was because I was rested up and fresh, either. I know it.
I was refraining heroically from mentioning the fact.
Thanks so much. Well, the naughty point, you remember, was what could be the possible effect of a small electric current in liberating the power? Now, I think I've got it. It must ship the Epsilon Gamma Zeta plane. And if it does, the rate of liberation must be zero when the angle theta is zero and approach infinity as theta approaches pi over 2.
It does not, Crane contradicted flatly. It can't. The orientation of that plane is fixed by a temperature, by nothing except temperature.
Well, that's so usually, but that's where the X comes in, and here's the proof.
On and on the argument raged. Reference works littered the table and overflowed onto the floor. Scratch paper grew into piles. Both computers ran almost continuously. Since the mathematical details of the Seaton-Crane effect are of little or no interest here, it will suffice to mention a few of the conclusions at which the two men arrived. The power could be controlled. It could drive or pull a spaceship. It could be used as an explosive in violences ranging from that of a 20-millimeter shell up to any upper limit desired, however fantastic, when expressed in megatons of TNT. And there were many other possibilities inherent in their final equations. Possibilities which the men did not at that time explore.
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter in The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies.